Be sure to stay tuned to the end of this episode as I'll be announcing the winners of the very first User Defenders giveaway.
You can't have unchecked growth, and you can't be exceptional at generalizing. You just can't. We can be good at a few things as humans. And if we try and be good at too many things, we won't be good at anything at all.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 25. I'm your host, Jason Ogle, and I realize I haven't said that for a long time, so there you go. Today I had the privilege of speaking with UX designer and instructor Ashley Carr. Ashley has such a depth of knowledge in our beloved field. She has the gift of fighting for the users with empathy and using both sides of her brain. You'll learn much more about that in the interview. Now get ready for my deep dive with Ashley Carr. This episode is brought to you in part by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Whether you started as a digital company or not, we're all digital now, and that's been a tough transition for many organizations. Universal Mind helps mid to enterprise-sized companies find and deliver something valuable through design thinking workshops, UX design, and development consulting, and believes in supporting user defenders to help train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Ashley Carr is an academically trained human factors engineer and anthropologist focusing on human-computer interaction, user experience, research, and design. She has her BA in anthropology from UCLA and MS in human factors and systems engineering from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Included among her many published writings is a behavioral psychology textbook for Oxford University Press. She has worked with organizations such as Walmart, Frontier Communications, and the Veterans Administration. Currently, she teaches and designs instructional material for user experience design immersive courses with General Assembly and manages all immersive courses at General Assembly, Seattle. She is passionate about teaching tech and encouraging creative confidence. She also happens to be a descendant of King Edward I and Queen Eleanor of Castile. Wow. So we have royalty on the show. That is awesome. Ashley, I am super excited to have you on User Defenders today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments just to give us a look into your personal life.
Sail. Sailing now quite a bit. And I'm going toward some American Sailing Association certifications, which are quite nice. And then I have a dog that I love, and we spend time with her. And I cook as much as I can, healthy food and clean. And that's pretty much like day to day. I sail, I hang out with my dog, I cook, I clean, I sleep.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Those are fun things. The sailing thing is really intriguing. I think that's awesome. I wish we had water in Colorado. I would try to sail too. So tell us your origin story, Ash. What inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
So I started out at UCLA as an undergrad many years ago, as an anthropology major, because I really liked the professors. I liked the other people who chose this as their major. And I thought that my entire life, I'm going to have to deal with people. And so it would make sense for me to understand people. And I also found that it was kind of satisfying. I call it is midbrain and mid-campus. So at UCLA, North Campus are like liberal arts. That's where liberal arts classes are held. And then South Campus is where the sciences are held. And then in the middle of campus, you get social sciences, where you can use kind of like both creative and analytical parts of your brain. And so I decided to be a mid-campus person, and because I'm a mid-brain person. But there are not a lot of jobs available for undergrads with anthropology degrees. So I taught myself front end in the early 2000s and did a lot of web copywriting. And then I also taught yoga and Pilates, and I dealt with a lot of people with overuse injuries and musculoskeletal disorders, and I started becoming interested in kind of solving these problems from a zoomed out standpoint. So rather than working like individual by individual, helping solve some of the problems in a larger scale that lead to chronic pain and overuse injuries. And so But then I got involved in finance, and I really enjoyed finance math. And I got to this point in my mid to late 20s where I had a lot of things that I really loved and was really interested in. And then I ended up finding out about Human Factors and the Human Factors and Ergonomic Society. And Human Factors is, we kind of consider, if we're human factors engineers, we consider HCI, which stands for human-computer interaction, a subfield of human factors engineering. And depending on your discipline, you would categorize it differently, which I'm totally fine with. And then we would consider UX to be a subcategory of HCI. And so I ended up discovering this academic discipline and then professional field where my background in anthropology, my experience in web development and design, my experience with workspaces, I guess, and machines and these kinds of things. And then also, was the last bit, math, and the math that I really enjoyed with finance. They could all kind of coalesce and come together in one field. So I didn't have to pick just one. I found something that included all of them. But I think mainly now I know this term, socio-technical system. I am really passionate about socio-technical systems and making sure that tech, and tech is just the Greek for, I say human-made. If you look it up, it's going to say man-made, but women make things too, so I like to say human-made.
Right.
Tech is just Greek for human-made. And I care very much that the things that we make do more good than harm to the people using those systems. And I think most of us, none of us are, not very many of us have bad intentions, but most of us never think, most of us have a hard time thinking through the effects of our cause. And I wanted to be involved in some way in helping make sure that our socio-technical systems, like I said, did cumulatively more good than harm to people and other living creatures. So that's kind of how I got involved in this field.
Wow. You have quite an extensive background, Ashley. It's quite impressive. Just thinking about kind of all of the things that you studied and been intrigued by and just dove into, I can't see how that hasn't made you a better designer, to have all these different influences and a lot of it involving people and behaviors and human factors and bringing in the writing side and the engineering side. And would you say that's really helped you to really excel in this field?
Yes and no. I think anything that, like any characteristic, is a double-edged sword. I've been turned down for way more jobs than I was given, but that's kind of normal. Like most people go through, you know, sending out of lots of resumes and doing lots of interviews and lots of rejections. And then you get one and you take it and you go from there. And you know, some of the biggest hurdles and biggest stumbling blocks for me is that, that people don't, how do I say this? Like, I might, just as an example, I have too much of an academic background. And so people translate that as me not able to actually push something out the door given a deadline. Or I have also really struggled with being held back by my visual design skills. And I know a lot of people in UX, this is kind of they have the same struggle because right now, if we're building, you know, native applications or websites or something like that, there is this extremely visual, extremely important visual component to what we're doing. Yeah. And it's also hard for a lot of people to understand our process and kind of how we do what we do and how the process we have to go through in order to make effective designs. And what a lot of people see at the end is just the spit and polish. Hmm. And most of us are not spit and polish production artists. So we end up getting passed over for spit and polish production artists who are excellent at that, but they don't have the kind of training and the kind of background in order to do, for example, really solid information architecture, really solid interaction design, or do the user research that kind of pulls in the data that we need in order to make these designs. So part of that is getting passed over because there's this dissonance between what UX actually is and what the perception of what it is in industry. Mm-hmm. I've studied a lot. I don't want to jump ahead too much, but one of my superpowers is studying. But, you know, people whose superpowers are studying, that's like a block in a lot of other areas in their life. So, yes, it does help. It does help to have such a varied background and to be so well studied and have a lot of experience. But, you know, there are two sides to every single coin, and it has harmed me and hurt me in my career trajectory. So,
very interesting answer. To specialize or generalize, what do you think? I mean, I've heard arguments on both sides, and you've touched on it a little bit. It's sort of like it depends, kind of the design sort of answer that we use for a lot of things. But what do you think, like now, for now, and maybe even for future, what do you think for our defenders listening? Should they really sort of broaden their horizons and try to dive into a lot of different things related to the field, or should they really just target one area and specialize?
So I'm going to give a definitive answer, which means that every time that somebody says, this is like, it's not Murphy's Law, it's Ashley's Law. Ashley's Law is every time I give a definitive answer, like 100% of people disagree and want to argue with me, which is okay. Yeah. But, so my definitive answer is never spread yourself too thin. And if all you ever are is a generalist, then you are never going to be effective and you are never going to be happy and you are always going to be confused. Mm. I think it's important. It's absolutely important to understand our process, like UX process, something like design. Oh, I'm sorry, not design. Research, strategize, plan, design, test, iterate, launch, something like that. However, as humans, we are limited. We have limits. And if we try and push those limits, we get diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. We have these things called optimization curves that are a fact. And when we live in a culture that is obsessed with growth and unchecked growth, that is directly at odds with this physical reality of optimization curves. You can't have unchecked growth, and you can't be exceptional at generalizing. You just can't. Hmm. We can be good at a few things as humans. Hmm. And if we try and be good at too many things, we won't be good at anything at all. And And it's a fallacy to think hiring managers, people that are dealing with budgets, whatever, that you can try and get a product out the door and into market that's good with a few generalists, you're not going to have a very good product.
Hmm. Wow. Usually it takes us a little while to start deep diving on the show, and we're already there. So this is awesome. Loving this. That's great. Ashley, who's been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
I'll talk about a couple industry people in a moment, but this is not a person. It's my dog. My dog has been the most helpful living creature because she reminds me that that there are much more important things than deadlines, timelines, and to-do lists.
Wow. I did not see that coming. That's great.
Oh, yeah. My in my field, you know, I've actually never met them, but Don Norman, Alan Cooper, and Yvonne Rogers are the three people whose writings and teachings have been the most helpful to me.
Wow. I've heard of the first two. I haven't heard of the third.
Yeah, so she's more of an academic, which is one of the reasons why she's sadly not as well known. And I also think because she's the one female in that group, and no offense to you or anyone else, but we all know that women tend to be, especially in engineering and technical fields, and also in the arts, women tend to be very, very seriously underrepresented. I've heard some really interesting, this is art, not technology, but like if you just do a tally mark of all of the, in like a liberal way, of all of the women who have been like on display at the Met or some museums like that, like basically it is very easy to get into the Met as a female if you are like a nude model for a male painter or sculptor. But if you are a female painter or sculptor, good luck getting into the Met or other big museums. So anyway, Yvonne Rogers, the one female in that group, she's also an academic. She also tends to be more on the social end of the socio-technical system. She focuses a little more on the human than the machine. And I think this is also a reason why she doesn't get quite as much attention. Because there's like a little more intrigue and interest in industry and also in pop culture with the technology, as opposed to the people that have to use the technology that doesn't work so well all the time. And she's at UCL, University College London, and she also she co-authored with another two authors, and I believe they're all female. It's Rogers, Sharp, and Preece, this book called Interaction Design Beyond Human-Computer Interaction. Hmm. And in my graduate program, that's actually how I was formally introduced to human-computer interaction, interaction design, user experience design, was through her book. And it's really helpful. It's a slightly more academic version of, say, Cooper's About Face. But I think that anyone who gets into this field needs to know who she is and needs to have a copy of that book in their library. Maybe not read it word for word, but definitely use it as a reference.
That's great. You've done our defenders a great service by putting her on the platform she deserves to be on. So I'm definitely going to make sure I put links in the show notes to those things you mentioned about Yvonne.
Thank you.
Absolutely. If you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your second career choice and why?
Well, right now I think I would be a sailing instructor, but it's because sailing is new. I haven't done it for that long. And so I haven't reached that critical point of it being a job. I think, and everything, this is one of the reasons why I'm careful about turning things that I love into the world of commerce and commodity, because then it becomes something really different. So I think if you love something and are really passionate about something, keep it out of the world of commerce and commodities, which is why I don't do business with friends or family. Right now I would say be a sailing instructor, but you know, if I wasn't, I think possibly, I don't know. I don't know what else I would be doing. Right now I moved into a management position. And so I'm not designing actually, I'm managing, which is a little different, but I'm trying this out, this management thing out, So I'm managing designers and developers.
So I guess
it's something a little different. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, that's awesome. And I appreciate what you said about choosing something like that you enjoy doing, but being careful about the commerce side of it. I definitely can see how that could be a challenge, because when you start doing something that you love all the time and then it becomes about business too much, that can kind of maybe kill your love a little bit for it. So I think that's a really interesting point you made. Let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation. Now, every superhero goes. Yeah, we're gonna go into chapter two of our superhero journey for you, Ashley. So every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. Now, certainly significant among those is failure. Failure is not something we like to talk about, or certainly not put on our LinkedIn page, but it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Can you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Yeah, so my biggest failures, when I thought about this earlier, I talked about when I was younger and in my career not standing up for myself, and in particular not standing up for myself because of people discrediting what I had to say because I was young and female, and I look younger and I sound younger than I actually am. And I'm 35 now. And when I was in my mid 20s, it was even worse. And I appreciate on a personal level that I am like young at heart and age rather slowly physically, but it can be a little challenging when you're, in the work world. But another, I think honestly, more important than that is my failure of setting boundaries and saying no. And that's also part of sticking up for myself. But everyone puts a lot of pressure on ourselves, but we also are put under a lot of pressure in our jobs in general. And I think we, all of us, like overestimate how much we can do. We underestimate how much it's going to cost. And we underestimate how long it's going to take, because we don't just want to do good jobs. We want to do amazing jobs.
Yeah.
However, and we're also afraid that if we're realistic in our estimation of time and cost and all of that, if we're realistic, then we're going to get turned down, we're going to get in trouble, etc. But what ends up happening is that people end up breaking, either relationships break down, and people get fired or people quit. There's high turnover. People get sick. Products are not good if you actually push them out. And it's just, I think my biggest mistake, my biggest failure is not saying no soon enough and not being exceedingly realistic and exceedingly clear about what I am capable of and what I'm not capable of, and just being honest and realistic about that. Unfortunately, in the situations where I have done that, there have been negative consequences. But there are negative consequences when I don't do it. And usually the negative consequences, I end up with some kind of serious health problem. So I think that's my biggest failure. And I would advise everybody, especially people who are giving directives and like setting up budgets and timelines and deadlines, to add some padding in for our humanness, so that we don't break our workforce.
Wow. Ashley, thanks for sharing that. I know that's you're being vulnerable, and I appreciate that. And that's setting boundaries and learning to say no. Those are things I've been learning a lot about myself, and I've been reading a book called Essentialism, which is excellent. Highly recommend it. It's by Greg McKeown, and it's all about learning how to say no, and just for the greater things, right? When we say no to the not so great things, when we say yes to the not so great things, we're saying no to the greater things. So it's really learning how to do that. And that's hard, because you don't want to disappoint people, but when we do take that power and we do exercise that, as you have been and as you've learned, it really, really makes a huge difference and takes us much further. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, what do you want our listeners to take away from that?
I think I like the term essentialism. Now I want to get that book and read it.
It's so good. It's really, really good.
Honestly, what I did in my new role was I wrote out all of the things that people were telling me I was supposed to do. And then I picked the one thing that I really needed to do in order to do my job well. And I am just doing that. And anything else that gets in the way, I'm saying either no to altogether, or I can't do that right now. It will have to happen 2 months from now or 3 months from now, or it needs to get, you know, it's going in my backlog. And so if the takeaway is basically, if you can pick in any given context in your life, and this actually relates to user experience design, if you can pick one thing that this design has to do well in order for it to succeed and help the user, what is that one thing? And your design has to be as simple as that in order to make it work and make it potentially profitable. And if you can't be that clear and that specific from the beginning and always with a design, I would put my money on your design failing.
Heavy. Heavy. I love it.
Why am I being so heavy today?
No, it's good. That's what this is about. Honestly, and I know that's why people listen to the show. It really is about diving deep, and I appreciate all your answers, Ashley, and can't wait for what you have to say to these other ones coming up. But yeah, definitely. And what you just said is totally the core message of this book, Essentialism. So I think you'll really enjoy it. And I think our defenders are going to check it out, too. I want to cut in here really quick. In this episode, Ashley and I talk a lot about the book Essentialism and the importance of applying its practices. And I didn't want to miss this opportunity to tell you how you can get this book for free. As you know, I'm a huge enthusiast for the written word, especially in audio format, which is why I'm excited to announce that I've teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook of your choice, including Essentialism. Go to audibletrial.com/userdefenders to get your free audiobook. Now back to my interview. So do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing?
Yeah. So this is my favorite story. So tell, we were using a third party recruiter for participants for usability testing. And they ended up sending us this guy who was an ex-con and fairly recently released, and had the teardrop tattoo on his face and like a couple other facial tattoos.
Uh-oh.
And I was the primary moderator, and for the test, and everyone was super nervous, but I wasn't at all. Like, I didn't get any kind of bad feeling from this guy. It was also on the company's campus. And we had, we have security guards at the front, and he got a temporary security pass. And this is actually something that if I'm in charge of the test, I don't do. There's like an observation room that other people can watch the test. I only let that happen when I am able to train the people that are going to be in the observation room. And this is actually one of the situations where that I give as an example. And honestly, it's because of the chatter and the talking that goes on in the observation room. The participant can't see and can't hear what's going on in the observation room, but people are really mean and catty. If they know that the participant can't hear what they're saying, then there are a lot of people that will sit in and observe and just say really mean things about the participant. And it just doesn't bode well. And you have like the designers and developers and project managers and all of that in the observation room. And these like mean things that people say about the participants, it ends up subtracting from the empathy that we're trying to build with our users. It others our users even more. And so I just have zero tolerance for any kind of like mean or catty or petty behavior or words directed toward participants at any point in the process, whether the participant is there or they're long gone and it's sanitized data. But there was this ex-convict, he was wonderful. He was an excellent participant. We got a lot of excellent data from him, and he actually was in the product's target demographic. So it fit what we were doing, but it was just I was definitely a little scared. It gave me pause, but I was like, you know, what is going to happen to me, right? Like, there's security all around. Like, we're being filmed live and other people are watching. There's absolutely nothing that can happen. And this guy probably needs the $100 more than any of our other participants. So let's do it. So that was probably the craziest thing that happened during usability tests. But the craziest thing, it wasn't crazy at all. He was a great participant and it was a great experience.
Wow. I love that story, Ashley.
Yeah,
it's so good.
You.
Yeah. It's so you touched on some really interesting things that you said here about this interview. And one of the things that really stood out to me was about the group setting, you know, behind the one-way mirror or whatever, or two-way mirror, right? It's kind of what the conversation that could take place in there, and how if it's negative or if it's directed at the person, at the individual, I think it creates a bias that shouldn't be there, especially when you're trying to get valuable information. I think it creates bias and it's just not right. So I appreciate you being a champion and fighting for that user, really, in that way. I mean, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's really, really cool. Thanks for sharing that. You touched on this a little earlier. I'd love to hear you elaborate on it. What's your design superpower?
Organization and studying. Those are my two design superpowers.
Those are good ones.
Yeah. I am really, really organized. And you've heard the term nulling, right?
I have not.
Okay. So nulling, it's K-N-O-L-L. And it is, you've seen the photographs of like designers' tables where they've got kind of like a overhead shot. This is not the right word, of things laid out on their table. And they've got like pens lined up in a row, and then a journal, and then their glasses, and everything is like grouped and categorized and set in relationship to each other, where you either have straight lines, right angles, occasionally 45 degrees. You've seen those?
No, I don't know. I keep thinking of like Instagram photos with like people with their field notes and stuff. I don't know why I keep thinking.
Yeah, so it's a unique way of, well, it's not really taking photos. It's the process of arranging related objects in parallel or 90-degree angles is a method of organization.
Okay.
So that's nulling. And it's K-N-O-L-L-I-N-G, nulling.
Okay.
It starts with a K. And there's like a saying, and then there's a blog that says always be nulling. And it's just like, you know, like people's obsession and love of nulling. Well, you abbreviate that to ABK, always be nulling, ABK. And those are my initials, Ashley Brooke Carr.
How about that?
So I think it's
meant
fate.
To be.
Yeah. But just in terms, like if you saw my drawers, I actually, if I wasn't doing UX, I would probably be a professional organizer. And I actually considered going into that field. And did you know it is like a legit field, and professional organizers, they have like conferences, and they have like even celebrities within that. And there's this Japanese woman called Marie Kondo. Her last name is with a K too, K-O-N-D-O, Kondo. And she is, she's like kind of like a space clearing expert and helps people declutter and get rid of a bunch of junk that they don't need. Wow. And it kind of like, I kind of relate organization back to the essentialism that we were talking about, or like one pointed focus. Like if my house was to do one thing, what would that one thing be? If my bedroom was to do one thing, what would that one thing be? And try to just focus on that and get rid of everything else that doesn't need to be there. And you can tell also that I have struggles in my work with preventing feature creep, featureitis, scope creep, all of those things, because we all want something to solve all of our problems all at once, and that's just going to create more problems. So let's just solve this one problem right now really well, and then at least we have one solved, and then let's move on. I feel like I got derailed on that question. This is my design superpower. It's organization. And I think the studying part is the amount of time and effort that it takes to figure out what that one thing truly is, and then how to just like support, if it's a problem, how to solve it. It's an opportunity, how to take advantage of it. If it's something that's already good, how to maintain and protect it. So they go hand in hand, organization and studying.
Well, it's great. Definitely keep the main thing, And I think that we have a lot of temptation as product designers to want to throw everything in on the first, even on what's supposed to be an MVP. We want to kind of throw it all in, but really most successful products, they maintain that one thing, as you said. And and then of course they iterate later, but the main thing still needs to stay the main thing. So I appreciate that a lot. And I have my guest on episode 10, Jeff Barnaby, also echoes your sentiment about organization, and that he's said even that's his key to a success is organization. Mm-hmm. So totally agree.
Oh, I just wanted to say the MVP versus MVF. I had a very astute student, his name's Chris, a while ago say, "Why do you say MVP? Why don't you say MVF?" And I said, what do you mean? He goes, "Well, you keep talking about minimum viable product, but really what we're doing is trying to come up with a minimum viable feature or function." And I was like, you are absolutely right. Even in our MVP statement, minimum viable product, we're still being too greedy with what we think we can accomplish.
Fascinating. That's really interesting. Minimal. Yeah, because really that's what the argument's about, right? Is how many features are going to be in this thing. Mm-hmm. Man, mind blown animated GIF there. So that's awesome.
Chris Dykus. He is a very intelligent man, and he used to be actually a disc jockey in Korea, I think it was. And
sounds like an interesting fella.
He's a really interesting guy. Yeah.
Well, Chris,
he's a UX designer now in LA.
Chris, I want you to write a blog post about that. We all want to read your blog post about the MVF. I think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, adversely, what's your design kryptonite, Ashley?
Disorganization and lack of studying.
Okay. So exactly the adverse.
Exactly.
Right on. Right. Enough said. Totally get that. What would your UX design superhero name be? This is a fun one.
I just really like my name. I do. Okay. I don't want a different name. My first, middle, and last name, Ashley Brooke Carr. And I also just really like my last name and that it's spelled with a K, because it is, I mean, that is truly the spelling. And it's a Scottish clan, it's a derivation of Cairn. So that was the clan's original name. And we're from Berwick-on-Tweed, which is near the eastern end of Hadrian's Wall, and we were tasked with helping to patrol the wall. And as you know, the wall really was just a pile of stones, and just like any wall was built back in the day. And Cairn means like a pile of stones, and you've probably heard of like funeral cairn. There are cairns that were built as like memorials to the dead and things like that, and there are also piles of stones to communicate directions on paths and things like that. But anyway, cairn is spelled C-A-I-R-N, but Carr, my Scottish clan's last name, for whatever reason, we spell it K-A-R-R, and I really like that. And then I was actually nameless for 2 weeks. My parents couldn't decide on a name, but they ended up, they just got fed up and they grabbed a dictionary and they opened it to the A's, and it said, they flipped to the page that said ash tree, and it was an old dictionary, and so there was like a little woodcut of an ash tree in a meadow with a brook that was running by the ash tree. Hmm. And my mom went, "Ash tree, oh, that sounds like Ashley. And I've always liked that name. And this, what a pretty woodcut. And look at the pretty brook. Oh, I also like the name brook. Oh, Ashley Brook." And that's how I was given my name. And I just like it. And I don't really want any other name.
Well, that's, I appreciate the backstory on that. That's a really lovely story. And I love the scenery. You started taking me to places like brooks and grassy, yeah, grassy knolls, or not knolling.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, exactly. And Hadrian's Wall and piles of old stones. And yeah, yeah, it's a very, very much like countryside, Northern England countryside-esque kind of name.
I love it.
And
you,
I
also,
like that.
You also took me to north of the wall there on the Game of the Thrones. You also took me there,
yeah,
when you were defending the wall.
Yeah.
So well done.
Totally.
Awesome. And it's a great name. So that totally works.
Thank
you. So, yeah, one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
So this is a funny thing. So in the past, I've actually printed out something called Smith & Mosier, which is an Air Force report that was the research for it, and then it was written up like 70s and 80s, I believe. Hmm. But it's basically, it is an Air Force report about user interface design, and there's really nothing about user interface design other than like how to literally operate Illustrator or how to like write CSS, anything that has to do with conceptually speaking user interface design, it is in Smith & Mosier. And it's very big. Like if you print it out, it's, you know, 500 pages or something like that. So you have this massive stack of paper. And then I also really like using Deborah Mayhew's usability engineering textbook, which is also, this is kind of like the a little more old school, a little more engineering-esque version of what UX is. And this is kind of like part of my training as a human factors engineer. So I have been known to, when I'm coming into meetings with people that don't want to listen to the user data, kind of like my evaluation of it, and kind of like in meetings, I am the advocate for the user. There are people who don't want to listen to me. I bring in this textbook, and I bring in 500 pages printed out of Smith & Mosier, and I make sure that the timing is right for this. I will accidentally on purpose place / slam them heavily on the desk so that it makes a very imposing noise, and I have done this before, and it scares people. And they're scared, and they turn and look at me, and then I just smile. And then whenever I start talking about, you know, like some of the principles behind what I'm saying or explaining to them why it's important, I'll just kind of like point at the usability engineering or point at Smith & Mosier and maybe like casually flip through like I'm going to open a page. And then people are like, no, we believe you.
Oh, that is so good. That is so good. And, you know, you were talking about the aviation aspect of this great book that you're referring to. And I couldn't help but think of Alphonse Chapanis, if that's how you pronounce his name. And I know you also have written about him. But just one of the, pioneers, really, of human factors. Right. I mean, what he did for aviation and it just how it spread into everything else. But love that.
Do you want me to tell the story about how he started, his study in the Air Force? I can make it short. I can make it 60 seconds or less.
Oh, okay. Please.
So this was during World War II, and he had studied psychology. I can't remember which university he has it. He studied for his undergraduate degree in psychology. Most of his career was spent associated with Johns Hopkins, but undergraduate, I don't believe he got his degree from there. But anyway, he had a degree in psychology. World War II happened. He ended up in the Army Air Corps, and he was tasked with investigating crashes. There were certain aircraft with higher number of crashes than other aircraft. And what the aircraft had in common was the display. All aircraft with this particular cockpit display had much higher crash rates than aircraft with other cockpit displays. So because he was a psychologist, he was not an engineer, he was not a technologist, he went to the pilots And he talked to the pilots because he knew how to deal with people and question people and work with people. So he interviewed pilots that flew this aircraft, but in particular, pilots that had crashed but survived the crash to find out what it was that was happening that was causing the crashes. And what he ended up finding was that there were two levers that were right next to each other and identical. There's the wing flap lever, and there was the landing gear lever. And what was happening was, as pilots were coming in for a landing, instead of deploying the landing gear, they were deploying the wing flaps. And what happens when you do that is the nose of the aircraft goes directly up and then directly down, and you crash into the ground. And so this was during World War II. We could not recall all of these aircraft. So there was like a V1 low budge immediate need fix that came out, which was to put this a little metal triangle that felt and looked like a wing onto the wing flap lever, and then a round rubber wheel, something that looked and felt like a wheel, so you got visual and tactile feedback on the lever for the landing gear. And so they deployed this temporary solution, and very quickly the crash rates normalized with aircraft with other cockpit displays. And then, you know, eventually that design would get changed, so that you didn't have these two levers that had disastrous consequences if they were confused right next to each other. Mm. So they, you know, proximity was saying sameness, and then visual and tactile feedback was saying sameness. He had to figure out a way very quickly to differentiate for the user, which were pilots during World War II. And so this is kind of like one of the first studies that we consider human factor studies. And Alphonse did basically the same thing in the 50s to come up with our keypad configuration that we use all of the time. If you've ever considered why your keypad has a zero down below, and then it goes just above that, it goes 789, and above that 456, and above that 123. Hmm. How we came to that design, Alphonse Champanis did that working for Bell Laboratories in the 50s, and he was tasked with reducing error rates for operators. And instead of just accepting what people were saying, which was operators are female, they're stupid, should have male operators.
Oh boy.
Actually investigating what was going on and discovering that it was in fact that the design was not optimal. And then this was as a result of research, design, testing, iterating that we do now as UX designers. We have this keypad that is ubiquitous. It's on all of our devices. It's everywhere. We use it multiple times a day.
Yep.
And he did it. Yeah.
Wow. I did not know that second story about Alphonse.
Yeah.
That keypad is really fascinating. And you know what else I love is just the heart of the teacher that you have, and how you just, he just brought us to school right now. And that is just great. And I just want to take a second to really thank you for your contributions to this field, to all of the people who are achieving success and who have achieved success because of your teaching and sharing your knowledge and just doing that, loving to do that. So I just want to take a second because I just totally got that in what you just shared with us, just the heart of a teacher that you are.
Thank you. And I want to extend that along to my fellow teachers at General Assembly. I'm actually now not teaching at General Assembly. I'm managing teachers.
Right.
And pretty much across the board, everybody that I know teaching at GA, they come here because they have a heart of a teacher, and they really, they love what they do, and they love it so much that they want to share that love with other people through teaching. And General Assembly has given them that opportunity. And then also just in general as a company, we invest a lot of money in helping people become better teachers. We have a whole department that's just dedicated to education leadership. And I actually work directly with that department now.
Oh, cool.
So if there are a lot of people who are like, I love this so much, I want to teach it, but I don't know how to teach. We actually have like a department and systems in place and people in place to like help you develop your skills as a teacher as you're teaching your craft.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah, it's a really, really awesome company, and it's a really awesome thing that has been created and set up and that I was asked to be a part of. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you shared that. And I think for the listeners, for the defenders listening who maybe are further along in their career and kind of on the fence about that, like, I want to share, but I don't know if I'm a teacher, or I don't know if I'm qualified enough. Like, I mean, I'm one of those people. I mean, I'll be honest. I've been doing this for quite a while, and I keep feeling kind of nudged and stirred up to share. I'm just trying to figure out what that is. But I would say, I would want to ask you, how would folks like me and people who want to do it and aren't sure, how can they kind of learn more about doing this and with GA and things?
Well, you can go to General Assembly's website and go to our job board and apply.
Okay.
We have an office in Denver.
That's right.
And so you just like,
mercy,
just apply, just show up. We also have just show up to an event and just say, hey, I do UX, or I'm a developer, or whatever. And I've been doing it for X number of years, and I really want to teach and I really want to give back. How do I get involved?
Nice.
And we're, to be honest, it's really hard for us to recruit and find people that are really interested in teaching. And I'm still not completely, I don't completely understand why.
Yeah.
I really don't. But, you know, if there are people who are in their respective fields and tech, whether you're, you know, a data scientist, we actually have a data science immersive course. It's a 12-week course that we're launching in Seattle this fall, and we're actively looking for an instructor for data science. And we have a couple really good candidates, but we're actively interviewing now for a data science role. We developed a course with for Android development along with Google. It has like Google stamp of approval, and they helped us develop our curriculum. It's a 12-week course for Android development, and this is launching in Seattle in 2 weeks, and we have a great instructional team for that. And then, of course, we have web development immersive and part-time classes. We have UX immersive and part-time classes. We've got project management part-time classes, visual design part-time classes. We have one-offs, like just evening class or a weekend class. So we have a huge need for instructors. And then just like in terms of being a good teacher, I think the best advice I can give to anybody is, number one, learn to trust yourself and learn to trust your instincts. Because I think the ways that I've gone wrong in teaching are I tried to be like really prescriptive about how I taught, instead of just like having the students in front of me, like having this be kind of like a communication verbally and non-verbally, like, are you understanding it? Are you not understanding it? And just like being with my students. I guess this is both of them. It's being with my students and then trusting my instincts.
Nice.
And a lot of times, like, you can prepare all kinds of material and it's great that it's prepared, but then all of a sudden something comes up and you're like, you know what? I'm going to explain it this way. I know I prepared to explain it this way, but I'm going to explain it this way because I think this is going to reach you quicker, better, faster. And just being able to kind of like improvise like that and trust yourself enough and communicate with the students enough. And that's something I think that just has to come with practice teaching.
Sure.
You just have to practice.
Love it. And that's great. I'm glad I asked, because I think that there's going to be some curiosity now around that. So,
yeah.
Very cool. So this is the last question of this chapter or segment, I should say. And it's a kind of a big one. It's one of my favorites. It's what does the future of UX look like to you?
So I hope it's a lot more heavily regulated, and I hope there's a lot more understanding as to as to what it is a UX designer should actually be capable of doing, and that it's clear across the board with everybody, whether you're a hiring manager, a CEO, a product manager, or someone calling yourself a UX designer, that if it is UX design, that we work with users. We work with users during our design process. That's it. If you don't work with users, you are not practicing user experience design, and you will not get the ROI. You won't. You have to work with the people who you are, for whom you are making this design. And if you don't work with them, it is client experience design, stakeholder experience design, business experience design, personal experience design, designer experience design. It is not user experience design. Any UX, anything, department, team, individual that cuts out usability testing and user research is not practicing UX. And every time I say this, people come back with, well, we don't have the money, we don't have the time. Look at all of the teachings about UX. If you take the time to work with users upfront and frequently, you save time and money. The reason you don't have time and money, it's a catch-22, right? For usability testing and user research, it's because you haven't done usability testing and user research, and you're getting yourself into a cluster.
That's a great response, Ashley. I was just thinking too about working with users. Aren't we glad that Alphonse decided to do that and work with the survivors, right? If he hadn't, then that would have been a real problem for many more years. Many more lives would have been lost.
Right.
So awesome. Awesome answer. Let's wrap up the show with imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Planning.
Mic drop. Totally. I don't even know. You don't even need to say more than that, right? I mean, planning is key. If you aim for nothing, you hit it every time, right? What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
The Nielsen Norman Group's free articles. NNGROUP.com. NNGroup.com. They're free articles. Sign up for their newsletter. Read their articles. They put out like 2 new articles a week. Read those.
Nice. Can't go wrong.
Mm-mm.
If you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
So I did, there are actually two.
Okay.
But they're basically one is more like the industry version and the other is more the academic version. It's Alan Cooper's About Face. And then Roger Sharp and Preece, Interaction Design Beyond Human-Computer Interaction.
Those sound like incredible books. I haven't read them, but I want to now. Awesome. I'll be sure to link those in the show notes. What's your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
Read those two books. Sign up for nngroup.com's weekly newsletter and read those two articles. And make sure you actually work with users.
Wow. Bam. So as we close, Ashley, can you tell us about one thing you're working on that you're most excited about?
My sailing licenses.
Nice. Sailing. That's a great answer. Great answer. And listen to Christopher Cross's Sailing, please.
Okay.
You won't regret it. You will not.
Okay.
Why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
Go to ashleykarr.com, ashleykarr.com. And you can connect with me on LinkedIn and connect with me on Twitter. I have a newsletter sign up, but I probably send something out like once a year. Actually, it's really funny.
Getting very many unsubscribers at least.
No, I'm never going to say it says, sign up with your email address to receive very rare but high quality news and updates about UX design from Ashley Carr. Rare and high quality, she promises, and will do her best. It's rarer than seeing like Bigfoot. You know, like there are more Bigfoot sightings every year than I send out newsletters.
Oh, so good.
So I'm not going to spam you, basically. If you want to get in touch with me faster, like there's a contact form. So here's the thing. People freak out about getting spam and getting phone calls or whatever. So I decided to run an experiment. And I just put my email address out there and I just put my phone number out there. Nobody has ever called me ever from me putting my phone number on my website, like ever.
Wow.
So if people know how to spell my name and use Google, within like 30 seconds, they could be calling my mobile phone. So it's really easy to get in touch with me. You just have to know how to spell my name, have access to the internet and use Google and just like go from there.
That's so good. That's fun. Thanks for the levity there. That's great.
Thanks.
Bigfoot is going to be cited before you get an email from Ashley. And if you get one email from Ashley a year after signing up and you mark it as spam, you're a jerk. Okay, that is all. Thanks so much for being here today, Ashley. It's been a great, great pleasure chatting with you. I'm inspired. I'm going to be checking out the things you've mentioned. I'm just grateful for all you do. And I just want to say fight on, my friend.
Thank you.
I really admire Ashley's teacher's heart and how it came through so clear in this interview. Oh, and don't forget to sign up for her once a year email list. That was hilarious. Thanks again so much for listening, Defender. It means a ton that you choose to spend this time with me and my super guests. I'm super excited to announce the winners of the very first User Defenders giveaway. First of all, I want to thank everyone who participated. I've been so encouraged by your ratings and reviews on iTunes, and I love hearing how the show is making an impact on your life and important design journey. I also want to note that since I was reading your amazing reviews along the way, I didn't want to bias the results in any way, so I had one of my trusty sidekicks, Ben Wegley, pick two winners at random. And with that, the first winner is Goggy El Dragon. Wow, what an alias. Goggy says, this podcast was my first in-depth exposure to user experience design. Jason is a great podcaster. His interviews are very structured and leave room for fun exploration. I love the theme and the motivation behind the podcast. I am motivated after each interview to dig deeper into UX. I have learned everything from user experience and discovery to prototyping and user testing. I highly recommend listening to this podcast. I feel that all of the interview content is applicable to beginners as well as seasoned professionals. Thanks for the dedicated interviews, Jason. Oh, Goggy. That just warms my heart. Thank you. Thank you so much. And the winner of the second book by Victor Yocko is Inventi UX. Now, Inventi UX says, balanced discussion and to the point. Suitable for beginners and experts. Always on the top of my playlist. Oh, thank you, Inventi UX. I appreciate that so much. And it's an honor to be on the top of your playlist. So I just want to say congratulations, Goggy El Dragon and Inventi UX. Here's how you too will get Victor Yocko's amazing new book on persuasive design signed by Dr. Persuasion himself. Email me at userdefenders@gmail.com and I'll get you set up. Thanks again to super guest Victor Yocko and Manning Publications for making this possible. I've got some really cool interviews lined up in the future that you won't want to miss, so be sure that you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. Easiest way to do this is to visit userdefenders.com/subscribe. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.